Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I remember when the aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet, became a museum, docked just off the southwest side of Alameda. It was in 1998, and my great-aunt Jeannie was there. She volunteered as a docent for several years after its grand opening, and when I asked her why she spent so much time there, unpaid, she looked like I had slapped her in the face. "Don't you know how important this ship is? It brought home astronauts from the first moonwalk." No, I didn't know that. And almost 20 years later, I still never knew how close the Apollo 11 recovery mission came to ending in total disaster. That was until I heard this episode from the podcast, This Is About. Produced by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Radio National team, This Is About is a radio documentary program that goes deep into the issues that matter by focusing on the beautiful, awkward, and sometimes dismal things that happen to people in our lives. Today, they bring us the little-known story of the man who made sure that the first astronauts who walked on the moon made it back home in one piece.
Hi, I'm Jordan Raskopoulos, and this is about the unsung hero who saved the Apollo 11 moon mission in 1969.
We'd gone to another world to explore someplace so alien and yet so familiar.
Dr. Katie Mack isn't that hero. She wasn't even alive in 1969, but she knows this story better than pretty much everyone else on the planet. Space runs in her family, and she knows it's a tough gig.
Space is hard. You know, that comes back to that famous speech by John F. Kennedy saying,
"We choose to go to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon.
And do the other things, not because it is easy, but because it is hard.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard."
This is about going to the moon and some of those other things. But to start with, we're going to Cambridge University in Cambridge. It's 2006, and you are at a lunchtime lecture in the Department of Applied Maths and Theoretical Physics. Please take a moment to imagine what the people in that room look like. They're the kind of people who spend their lunch break attending theoretical physics lectures. Basically, it's a room full of legends. But one legend, who is not there, is Stephen Hawking. He usually does attend these lunch lectures because he's a professor at Cambridge. But Dr. Katie Mack does not want him to be there.
My talk is about primordial black holes. Stephen Hawking invented primordial black holes. They were his idea.
This is also one of the first seminars she's ever given. So all good, Hawking's not here. Time to get on with it.
And I'm just breathing a sigh of relief when I hear beep, beep, beep. It's Hawking's wheelchair, and he is taking his place in the front row. I put up my title slide, and I hear a mechanical voice coming from the audience that says, "Thank you."
Thank you.
I'm confused, and I think he saw the title, he saw him talking about primordial black holes. He invented these things. Maybe he's just sort of making a joke that I'm talking about his subject. I just pause, and I continue. And suddenly I hear,
yes.
And I can't really ask him to elaborate. He speaks through a computer. He can select words or phrases from the screen by twitching his cheek. There's a little sensor that looks at his cheek and waits for him to kind of wink. And if you ask him a question, it might take 5 or 10 minutes to get an answer. And so I can't say, "What did you mean?" So I keep going through the talk, and every once in a while, I'm interrupted by
yes,
or
no,
or
maybe,
or
I don't know,
or
I don't think so.
So eventually the talk ends, and everybody's applauding politely, and Hawking is just wheeled away. And I ask the organizer of the seminar series, "What's going on?" And he just explains it nonchalantly. He says, "Oh, you know, when Hawking is eating, the cheek sensor thinks he's selecting words. So there's this quick access list of phrases, yes, no, maybe, I don't know. Usually they warn the speaker, but for whatever reason, they didn't do it to me." My nervousness at the seminar really wasn't just about Hawking being a well-known physicist or even just that he came up with this topic. He was also a hero of mine since I was very young. Some of my earliest memories about science were reading A Brief History of Time and finding out that what he was called was a cosmologist, and then I knew what I need to be is a cosmologist. I don't know when I first thought about going into space. I think I do remember the moment when I first understood what space was, and I think I must have been just old enough to read. I found a book at my parents' house, and it had a big picture of the Earth on the cover, probably one of the photos from the Apollo missions where they were able to look back and see the entire globe. And I remember looking at that picture and looking at the title, The Planet Earth, and thinking, the Earth is a planet? You know, and I remember that kind of vertigo of understanding that I lived on a planet. Being a cosmologist really is all I'd always wanted to do, but it was beat out by the idea of going to space. And when I was in my last year at Cambridge, in addition to postdoctoral fellowships, I applied for NASA's astronaut program. Every few years, they put out a call for astronaut candidates. I mean, who doesn't want to be an astronaut, right? Who doesn't want to go to space and see the Earth from above? If there was any chance at all, I couldn't pass that up. So I submitted the application, you know, thinking that this was the longest shot in the world. And a few months later, to my very great surprise, I found out that I made the first cut. When I was waiting to hear if I would get an in-person interview, I got the news that Neil Armstrong had died.
Dave Astro Armand.
Tributes are pouring in for the 82-year-old who's died from complications following heart surgery.
It really hit me hard. It was unexpected. I didn't know a whole lot about Neil Armstrong specifically.
They called him a reluctant hero who always believed he was just doing his job. 43 years ago, 500 million people watched through a curtain of black and white grainy images as he stepped onto a rock in space and into history.
Hornet, Roger, copy out.
But it really struck me, partly because I knew that my grandfather had a connection to him. I knew that my grandfather had saved his life once. When I watch Star Trek The Next Generation, Captain Picard reminds me a lot of my granddad.
Captain, you are jeopardizing your command and your career.
There are times, sir, when men of good conscience cannot blindly follow orders.
You know, Captain Picard is this very honorable, very proper man, you know, man of great integrity, and they look a little bit alike as well. He was a meteorologist in the Navy, and when you wrote him a letter when I was growing up, you had to write Captain Willard Samuel Houston because that was his title. You know, as a kid, I always thought of my grandfather as, I don't know how to describe this. I always looked up to my grandfather immensely, but he was also a little bit unreachable in the sense that he seemed to know everything, and he was very proper. He was a real military man in the sense of, you know, always knowing exactly what to do. He knew all the protocols for everything. And so, although he was family, I didn't completely relax around, you know, because I really wanted him to think well of me because I thought so well of him. I thought so highly of him. I wanted to live up to his example. I found out when I was a teenager that my grandfather had been a meteorologist for NASA's Apollo 11 mission.
And for those of you who may just have tuned in, one to hear news of the astronauts on the moon from the ABC News Service, a song from Nat King Cole, I think the opening titles of which aptly describe our thoughts at the moment. When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
For half of us, the moon landing isn't in living memory. For me, it's something that always was. But try and put yourself in the position of someone who lived in a world where the idea of visiting the moon was lunacy. Remember how mind-blowing the internet was when you were first introduced to it in the 90s? The whole world was suddenly connected. Remember how life-changing it was? And if you were born in the 90s and have always lived in a world with the internet, I don't know, remember how your mind was blown by those blankets with sleeves? Space exploration was something so new, so exciting, and so dangerous. They were strapping people to giant cylinders of fuel and shooting them into the sky to put them on the moon. People died, pretty frequently and spectacularly. And not just ordinary people, astronaut people. And then they actually did it. They actually succeeded in putting human beings onto a whole other celestial body.
It was an absolute inspiration to everyone.
And suddenly, the whole world was connected. And then...
Eagle, Roger, we copy. It's great. Go.
They had to come
Roger,
back.
Roger, we copy. The whole world is proud of you.
Nobody really talks about the coming back.
The idea was that the landing capsule would come into the atmosphere and then as it was coming down, it would put up parachutes, slow down its descent, and then it would hit the water.
Roger, 47.2, but 9.5.
My grandfather's role in the Apollo 11 mission sounded pretty mundane. His job was to check the weather at the splashdown site. He wanted to be really, really sure. You know, this was Apollo 11, the first humans to walk on the moon.
Some 500 million people around the world were helping push Eagle off the moon and back into orbit. Apollo Control standing by.
He had access to, you know, good weather maps, and he checked everything that he had available, and it looked fine. It looked like there wasn't going to be any issue, but he knew that there was better data that existed about this splashdown site. A few years earlier, he had been involved in a secret Navy spy satellite program during the Cold War, and he wasn't a spy. He wasn't interested in any of that, but he was using the images from these satellites to study weather patterns. And he was no longer on that program by the time Apollo 11 started, but he still had clearance to see these spy satellites. And he knew that there was one that would give a much better view of the landing site than any other data he had. So he went over to the office, and his colleague, an Air Force major named Hank Brandley, basically dragged him into the office and told him that there was a huge problem and showed these pictures that showed that this splashdown site was going to be a disaster. There was a big storm coming, and the astronauts absolutely could not land there. But my grandfather's colleague couldn't tell anyone where he got this information. And my grandfather can't tell anybody because he has this classified clearance, but he's not allowed to share that, even with NASA. NASA is not part of the military and cannot have access or even know that these satellites exist. So at this point, my grandfather has to somehow let NASA know that they cannot land in their chosen spot, but can't say why or how he knows that. There were only 72 hours left. My grandfather had to go and approach NASA and say, look, you have to move the splashdown site. I can't tell you why. You just have to trust me.
36,000 feet per second.
They believed him. The NASA commanders said, okay, we'll take this information, we'll move the splashdown site if you say we have to, but this is a really big deal. You have to understand that if this isn't true, if there's no reason to do this, then, you know, your career is over. When the day came for the splashdown to happen, the capsule course was diverted. The capsule came down to fine weather.
Over the hill there shortly.
you're looking mighty fine to us.
A splashdown that was uneventful. Everyone was fine. It was a perfect end to a perfect mission. Everything just went great.
They are on the water. The astronauts are on the Pacific Ocean. Splashdown has been accomplished.
But at the same time, NASA sent an airplane to the original splashdown site just to see what was there. And when that airplane arrived, it found a screaming eagle thunderstorm.
Visual contact has now disappeared behind clouds.
This is a storm that was so powerful that had the capsule tried to land there, it would have ripped the parachutes right off the capsule, and the men inside would have died on impact with the ocean. And it's still, every time I tell that story, it still gives me chills to think of what that would have been like if, after this perfect, inspiring mission, the astronauts had come home and died at the very last second. And it was only because my grandfather was able to convince the NASA commanders that he was so trustworthy and so good at his job, and if it weren't for his reputation and his work and his character, the whole course of the history of space exploration might have been changed completely. It's hard to imagine having such a crucial role in such a huge endeavor and not telling anybody and not getting any recognition for it. I think that for a lot of people that would be really hard, and their ego would make it impossible to not have that affect how they live the rest of their lives. But my grandfather didn't become a celebrity for this. They still couldn't tell anybody that these satellites existed, and it wasn't until the 90s that the whole thing became declassified and he was able to get the honors that he deserved. But it didn't become really public knowledge. He didn't make a big thing of it. He told the story to his family. He didn't, you know, put out a press release and demand a parade. And he never seemed to exploit it at all in his career. It's a long wait between stages of the astronaut application process. You send in your initial application, and then it's a few months before you hear if you've made the first cut. I remember checking my mailbox every day and just, you know, holding my breath and thinking, you know, still I wouldn't believe it until I got that letter. And then,
"Dear Dr. Mack, the initial evaluation of your application for the Astronaut Candidate Program has been completed. The next stage in the selection process is
before
to
you
identify
can
be considered for an interview.
You must obtain an
FAA certified aviation medical exam.
This does not guarantee you will be interviewed.
Must perform the NASA astronaut.
It is similar to a class 2 or 3 FAA. For questions regarding the astronaut
please
candidate selection, 281-5870.
There was no congratulations, you know. The letter was very dry and to the point, but it was amazing to me. I really could barely believe it. By the time I made it to the highly qualified list, my grandfather was living alone in a nursing home after my grandmother had died, and he wasn't in very good health. I went to visit him at the hospital because he'd had some health scare, and he was recovering from that, but it was clear that he was not going to make it very much longer. I knew that it was probably going to be the last time I would see him, and I didn't know what to say. I wanted to use that time with him as well as I could, but I thought that he would want to know that I was still in the running for the astronaut program. So I told him that I'd made the first cut and, you know, that I would hope to do well. And he told me something along the lines of, you know, well, work hard and be good. And then I left and I didn't see him again. He died a couple of days later. I think it was a few months after my grandfather passed away that I found out that I didn't make the next cut. It was disappointing because I wanted to be an astronaut, but there was also, in some ways, a sense that I'd disappointed him, and I knew that I hadn't. I knew that, you know, he would have been proud of me anyway. Part of me kind of felt that NASA, and specifically the astronaut program, was a connection to him. And so when I didn't move ahead in that, there was a sense of losing one more connection that I had to my grandfather. And so I think that I did kind of mourn him again. So when Neil Armstrong died a few months after my grandfather, it really made me realize something about how we think about science heroes. I think it's important to have role models, you know, famous people who have done great things and shared it with the world. But a lot of science is done quietly in the background by passionate, hardworking people who get no fame or fortune. You know, my grandfather certainly understood that the work that he was doing drew on so much previous work. And the amazing thing about being cosmologists is that we're able to look out into the cosmos and understand something of how it all works. And I mean, I know that the work I do is a really tiny part of that greater endeavor. And Stephen Hawking was always an inspiration for me as a scientist, just as Neil Armstrong was a reminder of how far we as a species can go. But to me, and to the astronauts of the Apollo 11 mission, my grandfather was a true science hero.
And think, if that mission had failed in its final moments, then we never would have been able to experience Buzz Aldrin's incredible collaboration with Snoop Dogg.
All you need is the rocket experience. What you need is the rocket experience.
This Is About is produced by Belinda Lopez and Jesse Cox. Sound by Russell Stapleton. You can find us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you like us, please leave us a review and tell your friends to subscribe, download, and share. Ground Control, this has been Jordan Raskopoulos.
Over.
You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. As a kid, Cameron Henson listened for hours as his grandfather, Leonard Simmons, told him stories about his time as a police officer in Newark, New Jersey. Leonard died in 2013, but his stories are living on through Cameron and Cameron's mom, Toni. They both stepped into the StoryCorps booth earlier this year to remember Leonard.
Dad was working in a factory, and he would get off work really late, pass when the buses would run. So he would have to walk back home through Hillside. Hillside was majority white. And the cops used to stop him. They would always ask the same question, where are you going? Where are you coming from? And that would make him angry. And I remember him saying, one day I'm going to own one of these houses in Hillside. So he joined the police force. And that was where I grew up.
I remember I really truly believed that grandpa was bulletproof. Like, my grandpa's an actual superhero. Yeah, it could probably fly. Did you ever worry about grandpa being a police officer?
I never worried, you know. He loved catching a bad guy. But one time, street informants told him there was going to be a robbery of a bar. So he and his partner walked in, and he actually was shot at and shot the perpetrator. That was the only time that he killed a man. And he was hailed a hero, but I think he felt as though he failed. I remember hearing him weeping at night because he had taken someone's life. That's why he was such a good cop. He looked people in the eye and he saw them.
What would you say Grandpa was most proud of?
His kids. He loved you. You know, firstborn grandson.
I remember his wallet only held four pictures. And all four pictures were of me.
Mm.
When Grandpa came to visit, I would put on my Timberlands just to make sure that he knew that I was getting taller.
I didn't know that.
And Saturday mornings, he would take me to IHOP. One particular time, one of the ladies next to me looked at me and picked her purse up and put it on the other side of her. And Grandpa said, "You don't have to move your purse. My grandson ain't never stolen nothing before in his life." And that meant the world to me. I still haven't completely gotten over his passing.
I want you, Cameron, to know how much Grandpa loved you. But I don't want you to ever feel like you're off the hook. The legacy that you leave is the one that honors him.
Absolutely. I try to be just like him. And I want him to continue to be proud of me.
That was Cameron Henson remembering his grandfather with his mother, Toni Henson. Their conversation was recorded in Atlanta, Georgia, and will be archived at the American Folklife Center in the Library of Congress. You can hear more stories like Cameron and Toni's by subscribing to the StoryCorps podcast. Find out more at storycorps.org/podcast. And that's CORE spelled CORPS.
Time, my darling, is standing still. Tonight, my love, I believe that we are the only two people in the world. Oh, by the way, did you bring your guitar? All I want is moonlight, music, and you in my
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and many more at kalw.org. Look for The Spot under the Programs tab. If there's a podcast you recommend, let us know by emailing thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Thank you for listening. And tune in next week, same day, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW.